police quickly found a body. And then they found some body parts.
Violent fringe groups declare war on America.
They didn't recognize the government of the United States.
They said, the cops, the military, we can kill them.
There's no question about it. They were into evil.
But these terrorists are homegrown, the children of wealthy Americans, graduates of the finest universities.
The children of privilege were turning against everything their parents represented.
Suspects emerge with automatic weapons blazing.
They will become America's most wanted criminals.
They wanted to blow stuff up. They wanted the most deaths.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own, America's leading journal, Vanity Fair, investigates Days of Rage by Brian Burrow.
Manhattan in 1970 was a rougher, more jagged place than it probably is today. But this block of West 11th Street is beautiful as the West Village gets. It's a solid row on both sides of brownstones, many of them taken up by artists, actors.
It was a very nice day, as I recall. It was cold, but pleasant. I was married to Dustin Hoffman at the time, and I was pregnant.
On the morning of March 6th, Anne Hoffman is in a cab heading home from a doctor's appointment.
I told the cab 16 West 11th Street, and I remember he was going a little fast, so I said, slow down. And he passed 16 and probably pulled up around 22. And then I literally had my hand through the window to give him the money, and we heard this noise. It wasn't a loud bang. It was kind of a muffled, almost maybe a swooshy sound connected to it. I said to the cab driver, that's my house. And I just threw the money at him and got out and started running toward the house. I noticed yellow drapes on the street, and it was very crunchy under my feet. There was, you know, window frames and things like that were just blown across the street.
The explosion has not come from Anne's house, but from the building next door. Number 18.
The first and second floors have been totally blown out, and the roof and kind of the top are teetering like they're about to fall.
Ronald Waite is the first cop on the scene. He is guarding a nearby school crossing when he hears the explosion.
I heard a bang, a loud bang. It seemed serious. You could sense the alarm and people coming toward me, coming east on 11th Street. And I started moving in that direction. As I got closer, I saw black smoke. I was calling for help. I was calling for the fire department. I was calling for the sergeant. I was calling for anybody who'd come and help me out. Please come.
At that point, the building itself is roaring in flames with white-gray smoke floating up into the sky.
It was very hot. I remember feeling the heat on my face.
Officer Waite rushes into the burning building to search for survivors.
There was explosions while I was in the house that rocked my body. I went out and I went across the street, and from what people tell me, I was sitting on the curb opposite 18 West 11th Street. But I was just really out of it.
Fire trucks and police arrive as flames and smoke continue to spew from number 18. By 7 p.m., the burning building is under control. Investigators start searching for the cause of the explosion.
The first thought that people had was that it was most likely a natural gas explosion. That's the most common type of explosion that we see even today.
There was the rumor that there were people in the house. Somebody must have known that one of them was the daughter of Mr. Wilkerson, who owned the house.
The building's owner, James Wilkerson, is on vacation in the Caribbean.
The police are able to track down Mr. Wilkerson and ask him, well, who was at the house? And he says, my daughter, and maybe some of her friends. My daughter, Kathy. Kathy Wilkerson. She was a rich kid. She'd gone to private schools. Her father owned a chain of radio stations. She went to Swarthmore, good education.
Kathy Wilkerson grew up in New England, where she attended Quaker meetings.
The first thing police wonder is, could this Kathy Wilkerson have been in the house?
Her parents tried to reach Kathy, but none of her friends know where she is. The family starts to fear the worst. Meanwhile, investigators sifting through the rubble find a clue to another possible victim.
The working theory became Kathy Wilkerson and her friend Kathy Boudin were in the townhouse. They'd found a card for a dentist appointment that Kathy Boudin had made. They found it in the rubble. Kathy Boudin was also a child of privilege, had been raised fairly wealthy. Private schools, progressive schools, had gone to Bryn Mawr College outside Philadelphia. Her father, Leonard, was one of the most well-known left-wing attorneys in Manhattan.
Now both women are missing. Could they be victims of this massive explosion?
The police slowly began to crane out all the debris. A crane brought out this huge gray blob that was studded with protuberances. One of the detectives looked at it and went, "Holy Mary," and realized that these protuberances were blasting caps, and much of the ball was sticks of dynamite. Everywhere were also nails. And this strongly suggested these were designed not just to blow up a building, but to kill people.
Once detonated, the bomb would have hurled a deadly swarm of nails in all directions. It was a device designed to cause as much carnage as possible.
When they found a big clump of dynamite with nails and glass in it, that's, you know, when I thought if this one blew, I would be a dead man.
Later, one of the police chiefs said it was potentially the single largest explosive device that had ever been assembled in the city of New York at that time. The working theory quickly became that this was an accidental detonation, that somebody perhaps didn't quite know how to build the bombs that they were building.
Investigators conclude that 18 West 11th Street is a bomb-making factory. And as they dig through the debris, they start to find casualties.
As they were going through the rubble, police quickly found a body. It was a young man named Teddy Gold. And then they found some body parts that came to be identified and believed to be those of a young woman named Diana Auten and a young man named Terry Robbins.
But there is still no sign of Wilkerson or Boudin. Investigators question the first cop on the scene.
A detective named Gidney was the first one to talk to me. He asked me where I was, what I heard, exactly what I did, and who I saw.
Officer Waite recalls seeing two survivors on the day of the blast.
As I was coming up, there's two women, naked, just coming down the steps of 18 West 11th Street. Someone came with some kind of a coat or a blanket and put it over one of the girls, getting them away from the smoke. When I got back to the precinct, they wanted to show me pictures, take a look at them and tell me if you recognize any of these people. And I identified them immediately. I put my finger right on them.
Officer Waite points to pictures of Kathy Wilkerson and Kathy Boudin. But why did they flee the scene of the explosion? Police soon discover these two college-educated women from affluent homes are living a secret life.
Kathy Wilkerson had become, like a lot of young people, college-age people, during the 1960s, very active in the anti-war and the civil rights movements. And she had become a member of SDS, the Students for Democratic Society.
SDS was a student organization founded in 1962. It wanted to be an intellectual center for people who wanted to change the world.
What's going on in the country now is young people are trying to find out why, I think, why so much is wrong, and in finding out why, to come to some kind of agreement to how to change it.
In general, there was sort of a standard panoply of tactics: nonviolent, sit-ins, modeled on the success of the civil rights movement.
Kathy Boudin had joined SDS and become quite prominent.
I met Kathy Boudin around 1964. She was smart and grounded. She was utterly committed to the movement.
Both women went to college in the Philadelphia area and met through their involvement in the anti-war movement. But why would two peace activists be involved in making bombs?
The FBI showed up pretty quick, so then you start saying, wait a second, why is the FBI here?
The investigation quickly becomes more than just about what happened on West 11th Street. It suggests that there's a group that was in that building that wanted to blow stuff up. They're out there. What's going to happen next?
Police are searching for 25-year-old Kathy Wilkerson and 26-year-old Kathy Boudin, two friends from wealthy homes who are involved in the anti-war movement. They are the only known survivors of an accidental bomb explosion in New York City's Greenwich Village.
Boudin and Wilkerson are said to have crawled out of the house, apparently uninjured, and disappeared. So immediately, the police suggest that there was some reason these people ran.
Investigators soon learn that these two anti-war activists had taken their protest to a new and more violent level.
Police run a check of Kathy Wilkerson, and it turns out she's now in a group called Weathermen. And Weathermen, just about every policeman on the East Coast, and perhaps in America, knew at that point, was the wildest of the wild.
Before the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, before the attack on the World Trade Center, urban terrorism came from an unlikely source: the college-educated children of affluent Americans.
By 1969, everybody who'd gotten involved in the anti-war movement was frustrated because the intensity of the war kept growing.
The nonviolent tactics were not working. There were people dying in Vietnam for no reason. And there was a desperation about the fact that we couldn't stop the war.
Disenchanted, some SDS leaders form a more radical splinter group. They call themselves Weathermen, after a Bob Dylan lyric.
The lyric is, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. It was sort of a fancy way of saying, the revolution is on. You could just put your face in the wind and you'll feel it.
They were far more violent and far more radical than most of the rest of the SDS. A lot of SDS was just kids who wanted to march. The Weathermen, they wanted to overthrow the government.
Their slogan was, bring the war home.
They wanted to bring back the violence and the sheer awfulness of the war in Vietnam to the streets of America, so that America could see what violence actually was.
Investigators learn that Boudin and Wilkerson participated in a four-day rampage organized by Weathermen in October of 1969, known as the Days of Rage.
The Days of Rage was intended to be 4 days of riotous protests in the streets of downtown Chicago. The Weather leadership, about 200 of them, and a smattering of followers, essentially ran screaming through the streets of downtown Chicago, throwing rocks, bashing car windshields.
Days of Rage was the first indication the Weathermen were out for mayhem, for destruction. Many of them were kids that went to Swarthmore, to Bryn Mawr, to the Ivy League schools. This was a shock for the nation. The children of privilege were turning against everything that their parents represented.
Organizers expect the Days of Rage to fill the streets with protesters. But only the hardcore Weathermen show up.
People thought they were crazy. You stopped a war by marching, like Martin Luther King did. You didn't stop a war by smashing, you know, ordinary people's cars.
The leadership got together and kind of licked its wound and said, okay, it's time. We're going to have to go underground and launch a true campaign of bombing in the United States. And there were voices that said we should be bombing empty buildings, symbolic bombings of courthouses, major corporations, the Pentagon, and the White House. But there were others within Weatherman that said, no, to get anyone to really pay attention, you've got to kill people.
They said, we have to off the pigs. The cops, the military, they're free game. We can kill them.
Weatherman becomes the Weather Underground. It's roughly 150 members, Wilkerson and Boudin among them, obtain aliases, change their appearances, and move into safe houses in various cities across the country.
At the time that Weatherman began going underground in January 1970, it split itself up into three groups, what they called tribes. One in San Francisco, one in the Midwest, mostly around Detroit, and a third group in New York. The New York group wanted to make the splashiest debut, the biggest bombs, the most, frankly, the most deaths.
Investigators want to know, who did the Weatherman plan to target with the massive anti-personnel bomb found in the townhouse rubble?
They were building dynamite bombs they intended to set outside an officer's dance at Fort Dix in central New Jersey. And the only thing that saved those people at Fort Dix, the officers and their young girlfriends and wives, was the fact they didn't know how to build a bomb correctly.
It was made to explode at a dance of non-commissioned officers, people that would be the first to be killed in Vietnam because they were grunts.
Kathy Wilkerson and Kathy Boudin disappear, but the campaign of violence has just begun. The townhouse explosion in Greenwich Village is evidence of a fast approaching urban war. Over the next 5 years, the Weather Underground and other violent fringe groups unleash a nationwide attack on the government.
The new leader, a brilliant young woman named Bernadine Dorn, recorded in a single take a very ambitious declaration of war against America.
Revolutionary violence is the only way. Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
That was the first that official America knew that Weatherman intended to fight on.
In just one 18-month period, the Weather Underground and other radical groups detonate more than 2,500 bombs at targets like police stations and military installations.
They decided they weren't going to try to kill anyone, not even police, just bomb things. In 1971, they managed to place a bomb inside the U.S. Capitol. In 1972, the Pentagon.
Members of the Weather Underground earn a place on the FBI's most wanted list. But once the Vietnam War ends in 1975, the passion for revolution begins to fade.
The Weatherman really implodes finally in the winter of 76-77. The group just basically ceases to exist, and many of those who are wanted on old charges, typically to do with the days of rage, go and turn themselves in, they pay a fine, and go on to college. Kathy Wilkerson ultimately turned herself in 1980. She had explosive charges against her from the townhouse. She served less than a year in jail. Turns out she had spent much of her time in the San Francisco area, being very active as a bomb maker in Weather Underground. She was slowly disaffected, slowly questioned the reason that this group even existed. After it imploded in 77, she got pregnant. She had a young daughter, and they spent the last 3 years underground in a rough area of the south side of Chicago. But once Kathy Wilkerson turned herself in, Kathy Boudin stayed out there.
To authorities, this child of wealth and privilege remains a dangerous terrorist.
I did wonder whatever became of Kathy. I assumed that she was still involved in no good, but I had no idea what form that no goodness was going to take.
The world will hear from Kathy Boudin again. She remains committed to revolution, but her group's objectives are about to take a bizarre, even more violent turn. It has been 12 years since radicals rampaged through the streets of Chicago during the days of rage. The Weather Underground has disbanded. and the FBI is winding down the search for its members.
Certainly, there was an effort to try to locate any fugitives. But a lot of the publicly announced violence that was attributed to the Weather Underground in the past had quieted.
But on this October day in New York's Rockland County, all that would change.
Nyack, New York is a, I guess you'd call it a bedroom community of New York City. Beautiful town, lined up along cliffs on the west side of the Hudson River.
About 4 p.m. that afternoon, Brink's armored truck pulled up in front of the Nanuet National Bank at the Nanuet Mall, and a routine pickup of daily receipts.
Brink's guards, Peter Page and Joe Trombino, exit the mall and begin to load the bags of money into the armored truck when a red van pulls up.
And suddenly, out of nowhere, the parking lot just erupts in gunfire. Trombino is hit in the shoulder and falls. Page is shot and immediately killed.
There were anywhere from 7 to 9 subjects. They then started to load bags of money into the red van, approximately $1.6 million. And they fled the parking lot in the red van.
The whole thing happened in 40 seconds.
The red van drives to a nearby empty lot where the bags of cash are tossed into a U-Haul truck and a tan Honda.
Everybody got into the truck. What they didn't realize was that someone had seen the exchange. A young college student at a single house at the end of a road behind the mall calls up to her mom, and both these women see the entire exchange, and they call the police.
So now all the police in Rockland are aware of the fact that they've exchanged vehicles. We're now more focused on the tan Honda and the U-Haul truck.
Police set up roadblocks at the entrances to the New York State Thruway.
One of the key roadblocks is at exit 11. And within a couple of minutes, a number of cops arrive, including two uniformed cops, Waverly Brown and Edward O'Grady, and a detective named Arthur Keenan. The first thing everyone notices is there's a U-Haul truck right there, exactly like the one they're supposed to be looking for.
My father and his team approached the U-Haul. The witnesses at the robbery indicated that the shooters were African-American males. The driver and the passenger are both Caucasian. So there's a little bit of confusion amongst the officers. Hey, is this the right U-Haul truck? Who have we stopped? The driver and the passenger then convince my father and his team that they are not the suspects and that it's all big misunderstanding and they should be let go.
But Detective Keenan wants to know what's in the back of the truck.
Detective Keenan had some difficulty opening up the rear door of the U-Haul. And when he came back to ask the two people they had stopped to open the truck, what's in the truck, that's when pandemonium broke loose.
The back of the U-Haul truck flies open, and suspects emerge with automatic weapons blazing.
It was a mismatch from the moment everyone jumped out of the van. These guys are firing semi-automatic rifles, and the cops just have pistols, so there's no match.
Officer Brown, he's hit pretty early in the gunfight and goes down. My father's able to take cover behind one of the squad cars and return fire.
O'Grady empties his gun and was in the process of reloading when somebody came around from his cover and shot him point blank. Detective Keenan, he's grazed in the leg by a shot. Once the suspects think they've taken down the cops, then they start shuffling cars, commandeering cars, and escaping from the scene up Mountain View Avenue.
Officer Brown is dead at the scene. Detective Keenan survives with an injury to his leg, and a severely wounded Sergeant O'Grady is rushed to Nyack Hospital.
My understanding is my father died about 90 minutes later at Nyack Hospital.
A Brinks guard and two policemen are dead. $1.5 million in cash has been stolen. What police don't know is that they are facing a murderous alliance of three radical groups bent on violent revolution.
The robbery was committed by a small group of revolutionaries, some of which hailed from Black Liberation Army, Republic of New Africa, and the Weather Underground organization.
the connection, the alliance, if you will, was really not known until the NIAC robbery. They represented a very formidable challenge for law enforcement because they had taken the past violence to a new height. They called themselves the family.
The group is led by two known criminals, Marilyn Jean Buck and Mutulu Shakur.
Mutulu Shakur was a talker, a leader. He had a little bit of charisma, but he was able, by talking the revolutionary pattern, to get people to follow it.
His ego and narcissism, I think, played a major role in developing him into the person that he became, a criminal.
Marilyn Buck was a legend in the underground long before this happened. She had become affiliated with the Black Liberation Army. In fact, she was sometimes known as the only white member of the BLA, the queen of the BLA, some called her. She was an expert at putting together false ID.
Marilyn Jean Buck attained a lot of respect and trust from the black groups because of her ability to procure weapons. Within their group, they were superstars. There's no question about it. They were into evil.
Prior to the NIAC robbery, the group had carried out a dozen armed robberies in the New York area.
The family had been robbing banks and armored cars, especially, for 3 or 4 years, and had taken some six-figure jobs. These were not guys robbing 7-Elevens. They were fairly serious.
To minimize the risk of being caught, the family relies on its white members.
It was very purposeful for the family to use the white members of their gang to drive. In their view, the police responding would not be as suspicious of a white woman driving a vehicle in the immediate vicinity than if it was black subjects driving.
The money from the robberies supports the family's revolutionary mission to create a new nation, the Republic of New Africa.
The Republic of New Africa was an organization that wanted the secession of 5 southern states from the United States, comprised of all black citizens.
It sounds farcical when you look back at it now, but at that time, these people really believed that they were going to create this Republic of New Africa somehow. It's almost ludicrous and beyond belief that intelligent people could even think that this would succeed.
The revolutionary group that emerged around Mutulu Shakur was never actually very revolutionary.
Drugs were an integral part of the family's social activity.
Mutulu was a classic coke fiend. He was robbing banks as fast as he could, basically get money for cocaine. Everyone knew that most of the money that they brought in, while ostensibly going to mount this revolutionary war, that war only existed in their imaginations. The fact was this money was going for cocaine, and it disappeared up their noses about as fast as they could bring it in.
So clearly you had a group that their goal, their self-proclaimed goal, was revolution, but tainted by avarice and addiction.
The job at the Nanuet Mall was clearly going to be their biggest ever. They called it the Big Dance.
The Big Dance is intended to send a message that the family means business. $1 million heist, a new level of violence, a force to be reckoned with. Less than 8 minutes after the Brinks robbery and murder, South Nyack Police Chief Alan Colsey and his officers hear radio reports of the shootout at Exit 11.
I'm just saying, what am I going to do here? What can I contribute to this?
Colsey hears that some suspects fled the scene in a tan Honda. He rushes to cut off their escape route.
I fly up from here, northbound on Route 9W, continuing to monitor radio traffic. I'm on the hunt, going out to try and apprehend some people that I know have held up an armored car, shot a Brinks guard, and just shot 2 of my friends. And you sort of get in the mindset of, not on my watch.
The tranquil town of Nyack, New York, is shaken by a violent shootout. A new alliance of radical groups has carried out a $1 million robbery, killing a security guard and 2 cops.
Picture just total havoc and pandemonium. You have 2 dead police officers, a wounded police officer, and you have these subjects trying to make a getaway.
Police Chief Alan Colsey is hunting for the suspects when one of the getaway cars, the tan Honda, speeds past him. Colsey gives chase, racing through residential areas at 80 miles an hour.
It was like a Hollywood stunt operation. Tires are screaming, there's gravel flying. They travel down 6th. The Honda skids across the road and crashes into the stairs and wall on Broadway.
Chief Colsey stops 30 yards away and draws his gun, demanding the suspects exit the vehicle.
A white male emerges and starts to walk back towards me. I'm yelling orders, stay where you are, put your hands in the air, don't move. And he's saying to me, what's the problem here? We were in an accident. My friends are hurt. We need help. What are you doing?
In addition to the man in front of him, Colsey sees a white female and a black male still in the car.
Finally, another officer shows up with a 12-gauge shotgun, which I could have kissed him. And we were able to take control of the scene. Then we open up the back of the trunk and we discover numerous large bank bags, obviously from the armored car robbery.
The defendants were captured at the scene. They were immediately brought to the Nyack Police Department. They were processed, they were arraigned, their identities were ultimately determined.
One was Judy Clark, and the back was Sam Brown. In the passenger seat was David Gilbert, a Weather Underground fugitive.
5 years after the FBI believed the group had disbanded, the Weather Underground has resurfaced and joined forces with two other radical groups to form the Family.
They were very quiet and subdued at that particular time. I think they were in a sense of shock that they had been captured.
As Chief Colsey makes his arrests, back at exit 11, a passenger in the U-Haul escapes on foot from the scene of the shootout.
She ran up the thruway exit, and an off-duty New York City corrections officer sees her running from the scene, and he goes and he grabs her, takes her into custody.
They took her, and nobody had a clue who she was. She gives her name as Barbara Edson, and she's very nervous. But once the FBI ran her fingerprints, it came back. This is Kathy Boudin.
I was blown away. I mean, Kathy Boudin. This was 1981. The war was over. There was no reason for her to do this. It was a self-destructive, self-hating action.
That she was still involved in this madness, that it had reached a new level of berserk immorality, it was really flabbergasting.
The country and the world was reintroduced to this armed struggle movement that everyone had kind of assumed had petered out. And here they were launching a fabulously ambitious, murderous armed robbery. It was a back to the future moment. These were people from another time.
It has been 11 years since Kathy Boudin was seen running naked from the blazing townhouse at 18 West 11th Street. She had been taking a shower in the second floor bathroom when the building collapsed around her.
I was glad they caught her. I said, well, I finally got her, because she was in the wind a long time.
For those 11 years, Kathy Boudin lived underground.
When I went underground to research a story, I ran across Kathy Boudin. She was going from one safe house to another. She was very ragged looking, very different than what I remembered when she was in SDS.
Now, Kathy Boudin, Judith Clark, David Gilbert, and Samuel Brown are under arrest for their roles in the Brinks robbery.
We knew that we had several suspects that we believed could still be out in the woods. We didn't think we had them all necessarily captured that day.
Police now wonder, what other crimes did Kathy Boudin and the family have planned? but they are not talking. Investigators race to find out what they can before anyone else is killed. Investigators are on the hunt for members of The Family, a heavily armed revolutionary gang who escaped the scene of an armed robbery and a violent shootout that left two cops dead in Nyack, New York.
Security was a high-level concern for us in the immediate days following the incident. We had suspects that we believed were still on the loose.
We know that several of the subjects got away in the white Oldsmobile that was later recovered in Westchester County. The registration, the New Jersey license plate on that car, came back to an address in East Orange, New Jersey. That apartment was searched. We found a myriad of different kinds of driver's licenses from various states, other forms of identification, pictures of Marilyn Buck and others in the family affixed to pieces of false identification.
The ringleader, Marilyn Jean Buck, is nowhere to be found. But police do find a bomb-making manual, diagrams of six Manhattan police precincts, and a hit list naming specific NYPD officers targeted for assassination. Finally, authorities are able to piece together the whole story of the family and its plans for murder, grand larceny, and armed revolution.
Was shown by that search that was a safe house being used by this group who were committing not just Nyack robbery, but others.
The safe house provides a mother load of evidence for the trials of the four suspects arrested in Nyack on October 20th.
They were charged with murder and robbery. Judith Clark and David Gilbert didn't even want to participate in the proceedings. They didn't recognize the government of the United States. They said they were prisoners of war and wanted to be treated accordingly. As silly as it sounds, they were found guilty and were sentenced to a term of 75 years to life. They still remained in prison to this very day.
In a separate trial in 1984, Samuel Brown also receives a sentence of 75 years to life. Police would eventually track down and arrest two of the architects of the big dance, Mutulu Shakur and Marilyn Jean Buck.
Mutulu was arrested in 1986 in Los Angeles after extensive fugitive investigation, and Mutulu remains a guest of the federal government.
After the big dance, Marilyn Buck forms her own new bombing group. The FBI quickly closed in on this group, and Marilyn was apprehended in Dobbs Ferry, New York in 1985.
Marilyn Jean Buck remains in prison until her release due to health reasons in July 2010. She dies of cancer 3 weeks later. Kathy Boudin finally stands trial in 1984, 14 years after fleeing the Greenwich Village townhouse. Of all the major players in the Brinks robbery and murders, she serves the lightest sentence.
It's interesting that she's all about social justice and railing against privilege and things like that. But as soon as she finally got rolled up after the Brinks robbery, she certainly found the best lawyer her father's money could buy and ended up getting a plea bargain.
Kathy Boudin pled guilty to felony murder as well as robbery, and she was sentenced to a period of 20 years to life.
But in a controversial decision, Kathy Boudin is released on parole in 2003. After serving only 22 years of her sentence. Families of the Brinks victims, among others, protest her release.
After many years of not wanting to have anything to do with her because I was so angry at what she had done, I agreed to go see her in the prison. I don't know that she entirely renounced the theory that had led her to this appalling action, but she was deeply apologetic. And therefore, I thought she was entitled to parole.
She's a murderer. I believe she should be in jail. And I believe Kathy Wilkerson should be in jail also.
The Brinks robbery would mark the end of America's first eruption of urban terrorism. A danger that lay dormant for more than a decade until the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City.
My personal opinion is that the shock of people seeing these privileged kids, their kids, doing violence to try to stop the war shook them up.
These were young people who started out really with the best of intentions. They wanted to fight the Vietnam War. They wanted to improve the lives of African Americans. But they made a fateful decision to resort to political violence.
The weather underground is a haunting reminder of how things can go wrong. It was the largest, most vigorous, and dynamic movement on the American left in 50 years, and they blew it up.
There's no question that the weather underground, they were all in. Innocent people were gonna die, and if that was what it took, then that's what it took. And in this case, three men lost their lives, and nine kids lost their fathers.
The fact is, if you look for any type of meaningful legacy, political change, systemic change that they affected, there is none. About all you can say for the radical underground groups of the 70s, led by the Weather Underground, is that they're responsible for most of the security so many of us deal with at public buildings, all of which began with the first weather bombings in 1970. It's not much of a legacy.